This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
If you enjoy Philosophy Bites, please support us. We're currently unfunded and all donations would be gratefully received. For details, go to www.philosophybites.com.
The Buddha was born in around the 5th century BC, probably in modern-day Nepal. David Hume was born in the 18th century in Scotland. By all accounts, both were tubby blokes, corpulent chaps. But what, if anything, do their philosophies have in common? And is it possible that Hume was influenced by Buddhism? Alison Gopnik, a renowned psychologist and philosopher, has been investigating a possible link.
Alison Gopnik, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Well, glad to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on is Hume and Buddhism. What's the connection between these two? Because apart from in terms of physique, it's not obvious.
Well, when you look at a lot of Hume's philosophical ideas, they're strikingly similar to some of the ideas that are in the Buddhist tradition. And I got interested in this particularly because of Hume's ideas about the self. Hume has a really radically new, different idea about the self, quite different from the ideas that people have had before. So someone like Descartes thinks that it's obvious that you have a self. You look into your head and there it is. It exists. It continues over time. In fact, Descartes thinks that's the only thing that you know for sure is that you have a self. And Hume does something really surprising, which is to say, well, wait a minute, when I actually look inside of my head, I see thoughts and ideas and beliefs in combination, but I don't see anything that's me, that's that self that's behind all of them. And it turns out that that debate is very relevant to contemporary debates in psychology. So one of the big discoveries in psychology in the past 10 years or so has been that it looks as if there's not much evidence that we do empirically have a single continuous self. And the work that I've done in developmental psychology in particular, looking at children in development, suggests that we invent the idea of a continuous self rather than discovering it.
That's really interesting. So you're saying that children become storytellers of their own lives, as it were?
Exactly. So there's quite a bit of evidence that autobiographical memory, which is the most central thing that we think of as evidence for ourself, is actually something that's developed, that's constructed, that isn't there to begin with. Now, it turns out that if you look at the Buddhist tradition, one of the absolutely central texts in Buddhism is called Nagasena's Questions, and it makes exactly the same argument, almost word for word, that Hume does about the lack of existence of a self.
So Hume's got this really nice analogy of introspection giving him something like a sense of a stage with characters going across it, but no self which is there all the time that he's observing his experience.
Well, the analogy in the Buddhist tradition, which is also a kind of wonderful analogy, comes in this dialogue between the great sage Nagasena and the king. And the king says, Nagasena, you're crazy. You can't believe that there's no self. Look, who am I talking to? And Nagasena says, well, Your Majesty, first tell me, how did you get to the palace? And he says, I came in a chariot. And he says, well, but what is that chariot? Is there something about the chariot that goes beyond just the reins and the wheels and the body of the chariot? And the king says, no, of course, there's no extra thing. The chariot's just the combination of all those things. And Nagasena says, well, it's just the same way with the self. There's no Nagasena aside from my thoughts and beliefs and other parts of my experience, which is exactly the same argument that Hume is making.
So that's an interesting story, the parallels between the Buddhist sense of the self and David Hume's, but that's just a parallel. I mean, how could we ever know whether there's any causal influence there? I mean, some people have speculated that Hume might have been influenced by Buddhism, but it seems like another story that we're telling.
Well, in fact, for most of history, people would have thought there couldn't possibly have been any connection. And when I first read these two passages, I thought there couldn't be any connection because Hume is writing in the 1730s. And at that point, almost no one officially knew anything about Buddhism in Europe. Buddhism hadn't really been discovered. And what's more, if you sort of looked at the official history of Hume, people would say, yeah, and he was writing the treatise in this sort of obscure town in France, very far away from everything. Rusticating is the word that his biographer uses. Now, it just happened that as I was reading about Buddhism, it turns out that when you actually look, there was someone who knew about Buddhist philosophy in great detail in the 1720s. And he was actually a Jesuit missionary who had traveled all the way to Tibet from Rome just in order, well, to convert the Tibetans. But when he actually got to Tibet, what the Tibetans said was, well, look, we're happy to be converted, but first make sure that you understand what our religion is like. And if you can prove that yours is superior, then we'll convert. So he spent 5 years in the monasteries in Tibet studying the Tibetan philosophical and religious tradition. He learned Tibetan. He translated Tsongkhapa, who was the great philosopher's books, into Latin and translated Latin books into Tibetan. And he wrote a book, which to this day is one of the very best accounts of Tibetan philosophy. Only trouble was, because it was a book about Tibetan philosophy, it was squelched by the church and it moldered in the Vatican unread as a manuscript until the 20th century. So you might think, so someone did know about it, but how could Hume have possibly known about it?
So how could he possibly have known about all this?
Well, it turns out the Tibetan scholar's name was Ippolito Desideri, and he came back in 1727 to Rome. In fact, he was kicked out of Tibet by the religious authorities. Well, it turns out that he came back through the town in France called La Flèche, which just happened to be where, 8 years later, Hume was writing the treatise. And what's more, it turns out the reason he came through La Flèche was because in this tiny little rustic town where Hume was sitting and thinking by himself, there just happened to be one of the largest Jesuit centers of learning in all of Europe, the Royal College at La Flèche. And that had actually been Descartes' university. It was not an obscure place at all. It was actually a place where there was a great deal of intellectual activity and thought. So Hume wasn't sitting there being isolated. Hume was right in the midst of this college of Jesuits, a college that Desideri had actually visited.
Presumably, too, Hume wouldn't have traveled with an entire library. He'd have to have access to books as a thinker and a writer.
Exactly. In his letters, the college at La Flèche had 40,000 books, which meant it was an enormous library at the time. It was actually a better library than he would have been able to find in most of England at that point. And in his letters, he explicitly says, I'm here in La Flèche. It's much better to have a good library than it is to have university teachers. It's great to be here. There's people to talk to. There's this college of Jesuits. And much later, he actually, in his letter about miracles, says, this idea came to me as I was walking in the College of La Flèche with a Jesuit of some parts and learning. So then the great question for me is, who is the Jesuit of some parts and learning? Who could he be?
So presumably you couldn't ever actually discover that. I mean, just the conversation in La Flèche hundreds of years ago. How could you possibly work that out?
Well, it was sort of surprising. No one had actually tried to figure this out. Well, it turns out that the Jesuits kept extremely good records of everybody in all the colleges. So what I did was I actually went to the Jesuit archives in Rome, which was a great adventure. And it turns out that in the Jesuit archives, it actually lists the names and information about everybody who was in all of the Jesuit colleges. And when Desideri had written about his trip to La Flèche, he said, I spent a lot of time talking to Monsieur Dolu. And when you looked in the Jesuit archives, sure enough, there's someone named Charles-François Dolu, who was there during all the time that Hume was there, and was also there at the time that Desideri was there. And Dolu turns out to be this fascinating character. He knew all about science. He'd actually been involved in the expedition from France to Siam in the 1680s. He'd taken telescopes. He'd actually done astronomical observations in Siam. And Siam was actually a Buddhist country. So he had also lived right next door to a Buddhist monastery, and many of the Jesuits had gone back and forth between the two places. So the end of the story is, it turns out that rather than thinking of Hume as being off in this obscure place, he was right in the center of the one place in Europe in the 1720s where people knew about Buddhist philosophy.
So this is circumstantial evidence in a way. Do you think it's strong enough to suggest that Hume was really influenced by Buddhism?
Well, we don't know. For me, actually, the clincher is that we have one wonderful description of Charles-François Dolu, who was this 80-year-old Jesuit there at the same time as Hume. And it describes him as being an incredibly charming man who understands wit better than any man of the world does. And from everything you know about Hume, if Hume had had someone who was funny and interesting and knew about science and had traveled all around the world, I just can't believe that Hume wouldn't have really, really enjoyed talking to this guy. That's what Hume was like. Hume was witty and knowledgeable and loved talking to other people who were witty and knowledgeable. It's at least interesting that ideas about atheism, ideas about anti-foundationalism, particularly these ideas about the self, were ideas that Hume very likely would at least have heard of.
Are there any other aspects of Buddhism that have parallels with Hume's philosophy?
Well, In fact, Hume was very interested to begin with in the idea of atheism. So he wrote a lot, even before he wrote the treatise. He thought a lot about whether it was possible to actually have a civilization without God. That was one of the things he was really interested in. And one of the things that was very striking to everybody who found out about Buddhism was that here was this highly evolved civilization in which explicitly, although there were gods, there were kind of mythological gods, there was no sense of a foundational God. And in fact, the Buddhist position was even stronger than that, and in some ways also like Hume's, because Buddhists argued against the idea of any kind of foundationalism. So sunyata, which is the doctrine of emptiness, is the doctrine that there isn't anything behind experience, that experience is all there is. There isn't even, as Descartes had said, the self that was behind experience. So a way of thinking about Hume's moment in history is that skepticism had become increasingly articulated. And you could start out being skeptical about the specific ridiculous miracles of religion. Then you'd be skeptical about God. Then you'd start being skeptical about whether there's any independent reality, which is sort of the route that Descartes was saying. Then, well, at least you have the self, but you can be skeptical about that too. And the question is, what happens when you take that skeptical route? And exactly what happened in the Buddhist tradition was taking that skeptical route and then at the end of it saying, you know what, it doesn't matter. Actually, everything's fine. Even if there isn't a God, even if there isn't a foundational external reality, even if there isn't a self, our experience, our everyday lives, the richness of our experience is just the same. And that's exactly the route that Hume takes, I think independently, I don't think because of Buddhism, but it's a very similar intellectual trajectory. In fact, there's this wonderful moment where Hume has an early life crisis, which we know that he actually did have. He has this kind of nervous breakdown where he says, wait a minute, if I'm skeptical about God, if I'm skeptical about reality, if I'm skeptical about the self, everything's fallen apart. There's nothing for me to do. And there's this wonderful moment where Hume says, no, wait a minute, actually, everything's exactly the same. And that positive feeling is the feeling that comes in Buddhism as well.
There are clearly these parallels between Buddhism and Hume's philosophy, but there must be differences as well.
Well, I think the biggest difference is that Buddhists see their philosophical project as being part of a broader sort of therapeutic project. So although Tsongkhapa did dry as dust philosophy for most of his life, still it's all in aid of making people better, making people happier, making people function better. So the Buddhists think if you have this combination of recognizing the skepticism and then recognizing that it doesn't really matter, you'll function better in the world. You won't suffer as much as you did before. And Hume doesn't really have that. So Hume is kind of detached. Hume doesn't think that doing this philosophy is really going to make you a better person or make you suffer less. It's something that he's more interested in an abstract way.
When you were talking earlier about your psychological research into children, you suggested that children don't tend to have a sense of self, but they create it, which seemed to imply that you don't really subscribe to the Humean Buddhist position on the self because adults, by implication, have selves.
Well, there's an interesting controversy, both in Hume interpretation and in the Buddhist tradition, about what exactly does it mean to say that the adult doesn't have a self. At least one argument about Hume, and certainly about Tsongkhapa, Tsongkhapa had what Buddhists call this middle way view, which was that the self is an illusion, but it's a useful, important illusion. It's not an illusion you would want to get rid of. And I think you could argue that that's Hume's view as well. He thinks it's an illusion, but he thinks it's an illusion that actually does some work. It's, as it were, a real illusion. That's exactly the way Tsongkhapa talks about it. And I think from a psychological perspective, from a developmental perspective, there's a good argument that, for instance, if we didn't think that our future selves were the same as our current selves, we wouldn't do things like save money for the future or do things like delay gratification. And actually, one of the things we know developmentally is that the development of this autobiographical extended self is connected to abilities like delaying gratification, like not doing something now in order to get a benefit in the future. Now, if you don't think that future self is you, then what's the point, right? I mean, why should I be saving my money now for Allison when she's 80? Why not give that money to somebody else, some other 80-year-old, right? It's only when you have the illusion of the self that you can understand and act in a way that's different. And I think you could argue that both Hume and Tsongkhapa had that insight as well.
If the self is really just a folk psychological term, to use the philosophical jargon, if it's just a useful illusion, the question is, what use is it? Because what is the future self that's going to benefit from having this illusion?
Well,
Of course, as a psychologist and as a philosophical naturalist, I think that we can explain things about our intuitive psychology, thinking in evolutionary terms. And from an evolutionary perspective, especially when you've got a creature like human beings that have very complicated cognition, it is to our advantage, in point of fact, to, say, save up our grain from this year in order to feed ourselves next year. That actually makes us thrive and survive and reproduce in a way that we couldn't have done before. So even if in some sense it's an illusion to think that there's a single person that's the same, it might very well be that doing the things that come from that illusion, like saving money or considering the future or making plans for the future, are things that really would help us to survive and thrive.
Alison Gopnik, thank you very much.
Well, always great to talk to you.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us.